we're not creating enough space for people to envision for themselves, their own communities, their own families, what type of people they want to be.
Welcome to The Green Urbanist, a podcast for urbanists fighting climate change. I'm Ross. This episode is a conversation with Samantha, Anna, Nolita, and Christina of the Possible Futures Collective. I won't introduce them here because I want to get into the conversation pretty quickly. And they introduce themselves as the first thing that we do. Basically come from very diverse backgrounds, architecture, engineering, anthropology, finance, graphic design, all from and living in the Global South, and have literally joined this conversation from three different continents. This was the first time I've had so many people, four guests, on an episode. Which was really fantastic because it meant every question had different perspectives coming in on it, and I think it came to a really rich discussion. The main discussion point in this episode is colonialism and decolonizing sustainability. Now, if you're hearing those words and you're thinking, what the hell does that have to do with sustainability? You know, is this a history lesson? Is this, you know, I don't know, just a niche thing for people who are interested in, like, geopolitics. No, if you're thinking those things, this is exactly the episode for you, because I think 90% of people listening to this episode will be in Global North, Europe, the UK, North America, Australia, and we are generally quite blind to the ways that past colonialism is still being played out in the Global South. And new forms of colonialism are still going on, and indeed sustainability as a concept that's being driven forward by the Global North, by big organizations, by big governments, is also involved in this new forms of colonialism. And that is what we're talking about today. It's an incredibly complex, difficult, deep topic. It will be very challenging. Certainly it's going to take me a while to digest everything that we talked about today, but I invite you to stick with it right to the end, because it is, you know, these perspectives are really, really important. At the end, I asked the guests, you know, what would you ask of the guests, of listeners who are listening to this, you know, considering that most of you, like me, will be from the Global North. And something Sam said, I think, is worth putting in here to bear in mind, because it can feel sometimes when you're listening to things like this, it can sometimes be easy to become defensive and to find excuses and to resist listening to that. The point of the conversation isn't to be accusatory, it isn't to be make you feel bad, it's just to help us to think about these things that are so often invisible to us. So I'm going to play that clip of Sam here, which I think will be helpful just for framing the conversation up front.
My only ask is not to dismiss whatever they've felt in listening to us, whatever feelings that had come up, whether it be anger, frustration, or disgust, even, or this feeling that, oh, we're so misunderstood, they think we're oppressing you. There's all of these very easy ways to just shove it, right, back under the rug and to ignore it. And I think the request is just not to ignore it.
Okay, at this point, I want to jump into the conversation. Thank you so much for listening. You can find out more about the work that they are doing at Possible Futures by following the link in the episode description below. Enjoy the conversation. Okay, here we are. Thank you all for joining me on this episode of the Green Urbanist Podcast. I'm very excited to have you all. Let's start with some introductions. If you could please tell me a bit about yourself. I'll start with you, Sam.
Thanks, Ross. My name is Samantha Supaya. I am a product of the British Empire in Southeast Asia. I was born into a westernized colonized nation that celebrates to this day the arrival of the British, the oppressive city-state of Singapore, one of the world's most unequal places. I was born to a Chinese mother and an Indian father, housed and fed in a loveless, rootless, privileged, capitalist, westernized Asian society. I then studied, worked, and lived in the UK and Sweden, a mechanical engineer specializing in renewable energy who became a subsea chartered building physicist and urban sustainability consultant. I returned to Southeast Asia in early 2020 after 12 or 13 years away, I don't really know which, seeking my place on the deeply colonized, socioeconomically traumatized, infinitely biodiverse tropical subcontinent. Currently in the Philippines, my ongoing decolonial projects are in urbanism, sustainability, and regeneration. And I'll let Anna introduce herself next. Anna, please.
Thanks, Sam. Hey, everyone. I'm Ana Denardin. I am Brazilian, and I live in Rio Grande do Sul, which is a state in the south of Brazil, in a city called Santa Maria. This land that I stand upon was originally inhabited by the Minuano and Guarani indigenous people. And my heritage goes back into Italian and Germany heritage because my great-great-grandparents or something like that came to Brazil in a process that happened shortly after the independence of Brazil. When the Republic began, the European government was bringing very poor European families to Brazil as a way to improve agriculture and also in a process of whitening of the population. So that's the context of where my great-great-grandparents came here. And that's also a context in why I started studying decolonization as a way to try to understand where I was at all of this problem and what was my responsibility towards it. My background is on civil engineering. I'm doing my master's in architecture, but I also work with design. So a brand identity, website development, and also brand strategy for regeneration. And I will pass the word to Nolita.
Thank you, Anna. Yes, I am Nolita. I'm a Xhosa woman born and bred in Durban, South Africa. My mother moved from the Eastern Cape, which is our native land, before I was born. And my father, her husband, never quite left the Eastern Cape. He lives there, has always lived there my entire life, and has been raising us through a weekly weekend migration up the east coast of South Africa up to Durban. So my story is one of a myriad of examples of economic migration precipitated by the apartheid infrastructure and the rampant inequality that followed. I studied chemical engineering at the University of Cape Town, where I led a student-led enterprise, social enterprise incubator. That is what created the foundation of what I'm interested in today. I've worked as a process engineer for Unilever and trained as a water and sanitation engineer for the Department of Water in South Africa. That was where I got exposure to urban systems, their design, the challenges that exist with trying to provide basic needs in an urban system. I like to think that I'm skilled at making ideas happen. And currently, my projects and work are about the strategy and the execution of projects in youth empowerment, entrepreneurship, and urbanism. So I'll pass over to Chris.
Hi, my name is Christina Saison. I am a Filipino living in the Philippines, and for the most part, like most Filipinos, I am of mixed Chinese, Spanish, and indigenous Filipino ancestry. Now, the Chinese part is really because the Philippines, as with most of Southeast Asia, have been having a very rich and, shall we say, healthy trade with the many Chinese empires before that. And the Spanish part is, well, colonialism, which led to a lot of rape. And I am very likely a product of that. I have a background in business process outsourcing as a sweatshop worker, which is to say that I wrote about 8 to 10 articles per day for the sum of about $270 or so back in 2007-ish, thereabouts. Then I went into law school, and then I worked in microfinance, and now I have a master's degree in anthropology, and I have really been concerned about exploring the trauma that colonialism has brought on our histories as peoples of the Global South. And that's me. Thank you. I'll pass it on to Sam again.
Oh, thanks. So this is us, four members of the crew of Possible Futures. And there's actually two more of us who aren't here in the pod, Shahana in Mumbai, India, and Luisa in Brazil. A Brazilian permaculturist who is currently based in California. So that's us. Ross.
Thank you so much. As you mentioned, you are the Possible Futures crew, or part of it. What is Possible Futures? And tell me about some of the work you're doing.
Yeah, so Possible Futures is a collective who explore decolonial sustainability and planetary regeneration from the perspectives of the Global South. We work with partners in particularly the Indigenous rights and peasant rights movements across the Global South, who align with our direction of exploration. I guess we see that we have a role in challenging mainstream sustainability and regeneration discourse, which is highly dominated by privileged white global north perspectives at the moment. And why is that problematic? It's because those perspectives automatically minimize and exclude global south and other marginalized realities, perspectives, and approaches. We are led by iterative creativity and have various individual and collective projects ongoing. One of those projects is a four-month pilot course for professionals called Intro to Decolonial Sustainability. We are holding two cohorts, one in the Pacific time zone and another in the Afro-Eurasian time zone, and the registration closes 1st June. If you're interested, you'll find out more about the course on our website, possiblefutures.earth. As for how we come to the topic of urbanism, well, it's a very important consideration for us because cities are the main sources of pain on our planet, ecologically and socially. Cities are a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, a tool of cultural evolution as much as it actively evolves culture. And cities across the Global South are a function of European colonialism, of extractive globalization, serving ports of plunder, reinforcing class warfare through segregation, gated communities and walled condominiums within a stone's throw from informal settlements, where capitalists lounge by the pool, yapping instructions into a phone, to their minions in the provinces to meet growth targets imagined through increasing consumer and shareholder demand. Cities are gigantic pimples, running vessels and veins deep into rural realities, sucking ecologies and cultures, and reducing them into a number in a private bank account. Global South cities are today a mirror of oppressor-oppressed realities during the height of the colonial period. So that's how we come into this space with you, Ross. And I was going to pass it on to Anna to add anything if she would like to.
Sure. I think cities are a very concrete, let's say, way to still see colonization as a process still happening. Because something that I hear a lot sometimes is like people saying, oh, colonization was something that happened centuries ago and we should move forward and this is in the past, but it's not. You just need to look around you. I mean, in my city, it's a medium city, a kind of recent city. So the historic center of the city is not that developed, but I was recently in Mexico City And to start, you should just look at the historic center of the Global South cities. Normally are the centers that showcase this European colonial architecture. So historic center for whom? And also when I was in Mexico, this was really clear because the central part of the city was built over a temple, an Aztec temple. So it was completely destroyed, and they used the stones of the temple to construct the cathedral of the city. So it's a complete erasure. And something that I found really strange was when you were walking through the streets of the historic center, you could see everywhere these signs saying like, oh, this was the house that Cortés stayed when he arrived. Or, oh, this is the building that colonizer, blah, 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 lived. And this is everywhere. So it's kind of like, this is so strange because it is there. You just need to look at it. Like, this celebration of the conquering and the slaughter and the way that we tell these stories as something, kind of a myth of creation or something heroic. Kind of denying the violence. So these narratives also, the way that we tell the story, the stories is also something that is completely messed up, the way that we learn history in school, for example. But yeah, I'll pass the word to Nolita, so I won't speak here too long.
Thank you, Anna. I think I come from a place that has similar challenges, but also I come from a country that, being South Africa, just to re-echo, that has the dishonor of being one of the most unequal societies on the planet. So for us, the challenge is deep. It comes from a history that I think everyone knows, but also the inability to address the mechanisms that created these inequalities. One of the problems we have is that cities came to this country through colonization, but then they remained because of class and also the structures and the mechanisms that infrastructure created. Economic migration, like I said in my intro, are things that were precipitated by a clear enemy, but are now reinforced by things that are going unaddressed, and they're exacerbating themselves, and they're becoming worse to a point where culturally we've landed at a space where it sort of feels a little bit hopeless. I think as urbanists, as designers, as engineers, as many of us in the Possible Futures team, sometimes we hold blind spots and we have challenges. And especially what I've seen in the South African context is that we struggle with the duality of our economy. And the fact that the economy is dual is something that took a long time for people to address. When we build things, we build through importing European and American methodologies. And we struggle with designing the things that used to be intuitive to us. Because the challenge of building a city, the challenge of building infrastructure, is what you're answering on a fundamental basis is how will we live together? And as Possible Futures, we have a running joke that everything leads back to decolonization, is when it has been so hard to have a vision of how we will live together, then how do we go about designing our homes? How do we go about designing our cities? And how do we decide what we're going to be as a community? So part of our mission is to deconstruct a little bit so that we can be more intentional in the way that we build. I'll hand over to Chris.
Thank you, guys. And I just like to echo Anna about what she said about cities as microcosms of colonialism, because one of the things that I've noticed that has drawn me actually to anthropology in the first place was the stratification of societies that are very sharp in cities in particular. And my training has kind of led me to pay attention, for instance, to the interplays between rural and urban elites, as in the folks who are in the term that is used in my home city, Bacolod, alta sociedad, or high society. And with the exception of a few highly privileged folks who have, shall we say, roots in a lot of the colonial nonsense that has been going on in the Philippines for the past 500 years, the country bumpkins in Manila, quote-unquote, high society, are often considered the creme de la creme of my home city in Bacolod. And it's weird that folk would still keep wanting to come over here to Metro Manila, where I am right now, because this place is a literal hellscape, I swear. Living here is inhumane. Just for an example, traveling from one part of Manila to another can take hours and hours of simply trying to find a ride, because our commute system is built to service the needs and wants of, once again, those elites, the ones who have cars and the ones who want to have cars. So it's built on the dreams of people who want to be like their oppressors in very many ways. And yet people keep wanting to come over here and keep wanting to reproduce that kind of oppressive colonial vision. And in a lot of ways, the cities that exist now are both similar and very different to the cities that existed pre-colonially, in that there's always going to be stratification, presumably. There's always going to be social hierarchies, presumably. But we as a species tend not to just, like, you know, stick to those little boxes of, oh, there should be elites and there should be, like, the poors with a capital T and a capital P. In fact, humanity is very, very diverse in the ways that we organize ourselves, and cities are just one way of doing so. And yet somehow today, they are the default. And we in Possible Futures want to explore that in some ways, because a big part of it lies with the colonial project and with the continuing colonial experience that many in the Global South and in the Global North perpetuate and live with.
Thank you for sharing those perspectives. I find this really fascinating, because I think in the kind of world that I live in, a lot of people would say that cities are, you know, like the greatest accomplishment of mankind, and, you know, they're the sources of culture and this sort of, I guess, this sense of civilization being at its peak in a good way in cities. And I think that is a perspective that is extremely privileged. And as you say, most cities often only work for the privileged and not for many other people. So I think this is actually quite refreshing and informative to hear those perspectives. I haven't been to, I'm fascinated by these megacities in the Global South, and I haven't been to many. But I can only imagine the scale of challenges. And I think that this sentence that you said, Sam, which is that cities are the source of most pain, is a very interesting way of thinking about it. And Nalita, what you said about learning how we live together, I think is incredibly kind of pertinent in cities across the world, because we still seem to not really understand how to live together in many ways. But I would like to come back to, I suppose, colonialism, which we've been talking about, but also the concept of decolonialism as it pertains to sustainability. Sam, do you want to jump in on that and explain what that means?
Yeah, sure. Perhaps it'll be clearer if we start with what actually was or is colonization. And here I'll reference a few paragraphs from my recent Medium piece called 2030, The Ends of Worlds?
which, like everything else I do now, is heavily influenced by possible futures direction of exploration. Quote, after the decimation of the Black Death, 1346 to 1353, and a rapidly growing interest amongst the European ruling classes to bounce back better by controlling maritime trade through military might and intimidation, the Europeans set off discovering new worlds. The Age of Discovery, a global colonial endeavor that seeded intercontinental cartels called multinational corporations, was marked by drunken misdemeanor at best and intergenerational ethnocidal violence at worst. This one world sought to correct all barbaric, savage cultures, introducing the concept of development to those who were unfortunately unintelligent and ignorant of the greatest of European inventions, who must be convinced to partake in the growth of Western civilization by building rail systems and electrical infrastructure, by obtaining education certificates at Western European language schools to indoctrinate themselves into a developed culture, and by demonizing their traditional health and medical practices to upsell Western pharmaceuticals. This only worked because of military power. The white men had weapons of mass destruction, and they were unafraid to use them generously, all to power globalized capitalism, to feed the rich white men who rule the world while growing fat on overconsumption. End quote. This is the reason we have the Global North and the Global South. Generally speaking, the Global South has been oppressed in order to benefit the Global North. And this continues today. Eswatini economic anthropologist Jason Hickel writes about it in his books, The Divide and Less is More. To give you just one statistic, in 2015, the year we last had these statistics, the scale of net appropriation from the South to the North is staggering. 10.1 billion tons of raw materials, 379 billion hours of human labor, 22.7 quintillion joules of energy, 800 million hectares of land. That's in 2015 alone. All this was controlled, organized, managed, and coordinated through Global South cities, shipped through Global South ports. European colonization brought the Global South ecocide and ethnocide. It brought the Global North, like you mentioned, Ross, global hegemony to secure their comfort and excess. From our perspective, decolonial sustainability is one that rejects the one world's dominant narrative of sustainability and sustainable development, one that worships technology and individualism, that seeks to control global development, that remains unapologetic for the ongoing atrocities that European colonization, and avoids the admission of responsibility that would lead to the return of stolen land and stolen wealth. Decolonial sustainability is very much about undoing ecocide and ethnocide as much as possible through degrowth, land back, wealth back, and food sovereignty. Decolonial justice is just part of the work. The rest of it is literally none of our business, except where we are participants, because we should then be incentivized to return to diverse, pluriversal traditions and cultures that have always been sustainable and regenerative, where technological innovations go backstage where it belongs, and we learn to be human again within our ecologies. We wrote a chapter in a recently published Springer Nature book called Transformation Literacy, explaining what we think is decolonial sustainability. If you'd like to know more, it's open access and you can find it again on our website, possiblefutures.earth. And with that, I will hand on to Anna.
Thanks, Sam. Yeah, something that I wanted to compliment is that many of the things that Sam said has to do with this behavior of seeing oneself as superior than other people, or in the case of when we bring this to regeneration or sustainability, also seeing superior from nature. And these behaviors of supremacy of ego, of narcissism, is something that is still very present in the sustainability movement, of people trying to kind of show this virtuosity. So sometimes we see, like, and even in ourselves, like trying to, sometimes we try to do something that we think is good or that will help, but we need to pay attention if we are doing this as a way to also look good or be part of the good team, or do that to post it on Facebook and kind of promote yourself of how an amazing person you are. And these patterns of still, it's still something that you want to do to feel superior to other people. So I think these patterns of colonialism are still embedded in our narratives of modernity, in the way that we use work. Even if we are doing something that is good, we use this work as a way to promote ourselves or to elevate our morality. And there are many problems within the sustainability movement, like still seeing nature as a resource. So we try to kind of not cause more damage, but as a way to preserve ourselves as a species, and not necessarily because of the other forms of life, you know. So I think these narratives or these motivations or the whys and the hows is as important as what we are discussing and what we are doing. And exactly, this is something very important. Not only like the methodological changes that need to happen, the way that we are doing things, but why we are doing this, like this different ways of existing in this planet, like questioning what is behind all our actions and why we are doing that. And I think a key element of maybe starting to navigate in these decolonial perspectives is humility, like being humble enough to acknowledge your own flaws and your own, like, these reflections of the ugliness and the violence of the system in each of us, and not like looking in this mirror and not turning your back when you see this ugliness, and having this humility to try to gesture towards something different, not in this position of I know exactly what I'm doing, I'm amazing, you know, kind of these behaviors that we see a lot in this history of colonization repeating itself over and over again in different forms. Nowadays, in modernity, in a different form, but it is still there. So, yeah, I think that's it. And I will pass the word to Nolita.
Thank you, Anna. Decolonization has to be an active part of innovation and entrepreneurial thought. But as Sam said, technology, innovation, it is not the end, but it can be some means. And even then, not entirely. I think we've lost that a bit. We're speaking of the next age as if it is defined by the technology that we will have and not the type of people we will be. And as Anna alluded to, that we will be is not exactly global. We're not creating enough space for people to envision for themselves, their own communities, their own families, what type of people they want to be. We assume that people are going to be labor, and that labor is going to be influenced or is going to influence the technology we'll have. And that is what's going to define the next society. I would risk to say we may not even get that far. Recognizing diversity alone is not enough, but we also need to ask some fundamental questions. Are humans not nature? Why have we created that separation between man and nature? What is science? Who is a scientist? And what does it mean to learn? In a TEDx Possible Futures event we hosted the end of 2020, we had a panel discussion titled Decolonization and Decolonizing the Mind. One of the things discussed was that for any professional to be able to do the work that they do, they need to recognize the interconnectedness of the systems that they wish to change. So we cannot afford to be mechanistic or separatist in our approach. But also at the same time, we also noted that there are tensions between the emergencies of today. For example, right now, my home city, Durban, is going through flooding again for the second time in the last 2 months. So there are emergencies and there are things that have to be addressed today because people are suffering right now. But also we need to prioritize and have time and patience for what it takes to have a systemic approach to some of these wicked problems. The course that we're hosting does, in a sense, make it apparent that we are, in many instances, failing to understand that point, failing to hold the balance between the emergencies and the things that we need to allow to emerge. That colonization was not just a matter of the past, but a mindset that's very much entrenched in the systems and initiatives that we as sustainability professionals are creating today. I hand over to Christina.
Okay. Sustainability and decolonial sustainability. And I'd just like to be very blunt here and say that sustainability as it currently is colonial. And it dictates the actions that we need to do through the words of experts with a capital E and politicians with a capital P, folks who are said to be qualified in some way based on structures and definitions that are imposed on many of us. And it defines things as absolute. For instance, 2 degrees centigrade is something that was defined, again, by a panel of experts at the IPCC. And it dictates also just how many people are allowed to die and how many species are allowed to go extinct because of the nonsense that has been perpetuated by essentially the elites in the overarching society that now has hegemony over much of the world now. And to reiterate what Sam had said, decolonial sustainability, on the other hand, is about stepping back and letting sustainability happen, because the concept of sustainability varies from different groups and different peoples. So for instance, one indigenous group may call sustainability a different word. It may not even have a word for sustainability, but it may define what their life should be in a way that is very different from how sustainability is defined as. And that is just as valid, but is not being considered in the picture of what sustainability should be. And to say that, oh, well, all we need to do is insert that definition into what sustainability is, obfuscates the issue, because it is just another way for the concept of sustainability that is colonial to acquire or appropriate indigenous concepts or concepts that should stand of and for themselves. There is a sovereignty that needs to be respected when we talk about decolonial sustainability. It is ultimately, as mentioned before, about land back, degrowth, wealth back. It's about respecting the fact that people, non-humans, the world is sovereign, and we have absolutely no right to dictate from above what should and should not be. And as Anna had also mentioned, much of colonial sustainability is about enriching and enhancing the self, particularly certain selves in our societies, without much respect for or even acknowledgement of the existence of others who have just as much right to exist as us. And we, with the problems that we have to face right now, if we take the kind of top-down approach that sustainability as it currently stands insists upon, we will just perpetuate the same problems again and again. And one of the reasons why is because the definitions, the action points, even the terms used serve the interests of a very small group of people. And that ultimately does not bode well for our planet. Our species alone is already in deep doo-doo. And if we were to listen to, you know, oh, Lord High Mucky Muck, who says that, oh, we have to be okay with 2 degrees of global heating, then we're going to have to be okay with a minimum of 10 million people dying from climate emergencies like extreme weather phenomena, climate migration and the wars caused thereby, droughts, food shortages, water shortages. Hell, it's already happening. As Nalita had mentioned, there is going to be a flood. Durban, her home city, is already flooding. The city that I'm currently in, Cainta, will flood almost certainly because right now it's La Nina and the summer season has officially closed and it is raining really hard. And I'm pretty sure that by this time next month, I will be thigh deep in dirty flood water. Which is just to say that sustainability should take into consideration not just one kind of sustainability, but sustainabilities. And that, I think, is the most important thing that we need to listen to. And I'll turn it back over to Sam.
Yeah, I have very few things to add except congratulations, Chris, on getting the term doo-doo into the podcast. And separately, also mentioning that there's a very interesting statistic that beyond the 350 parts per million CO2 level, which essentially has been defined by white sustainability experts as the so-called planetary limit for habitable life for human beings. In excess of that, the global north has contributed 92% of excess CO2 emissions. And contrast that with who actually experiences the negative effects of that. That would essentially be in excess of 90% of the effects of that pollution being experienced by the global south. So this is something that has been termed atmospheric colonization, for example. So this is another way that we can think of or a simpler way we can think of colonial sustainability versus decolonial sustainability. I hope this makes sense. Back to you, Ross.
Thank you. Thank you all so much. Wow. I mean, kind of just blown my mind wide open with that. So many things. I've just been writing notes here and just so many things to sort of pull on that is just so perspective shifting, I think. I mean, this idea of a sustainability one world order, Sam, which is an amazing phrase, seems quite terrifying. Although I think something that I've been experiencing recently is that, and perhaps I thought of this as a challenge, and maybe this is actually a good thing, is the fact that as more and more of I guess society becomes accustomed to the idea of climate change and reducing emissions and having to take some sort of action, people say things like, we have to reach net zero or we have to reduce emissions, but we all have different ideas about what actually we need to do, from, you know, the people who just say, well, you know, what we just need is the right private market instruments to shift innovation towards carbon capture and electric vehicles and that kind of thing, towards a much more perhaps indigenous or much more global South perspective, which says, actually, you know, hold on a second, this is the very thing that is causing these problems. And it does seem that, you know, as we're at this moment of having to make very quick changes, it doesn't actually seem obvious what is the correct path to go down that will bring us back within safe planetary boundaries, but also is socially just. But I guess one thing that is becoming clear from this conversation is that the traditional technocratic expert Western driven narrative is not the one that will do that. Yeah. Also, another thing that I think jumped out at me as being something I'm very interested in is this idea of looking back for solutions instead of looking forward. And this idea that actually it's not about new technologies, it's more about reconnecting to actually where we've come from and finding the wisdom and the ways of life that actually nurtured us long before cities, colonialism, capitalism, etc. And if that's actually possible to bring that back into the world today. See, Christina, you have your hand up.
Yes, I'd actually love to add, not just looking back, but looking down, looking at the folks who have been most affected by climate catastrophe, and looking at folks who have been living essentially in a state of collapse since the 13th century, and paying attention to how they've adapted and paying attention to how they themselves interface with the planet and they themselves interface with their environments. Because there is a profound wisdom to simply listening and paying attention to the people around us and how much they not only have to give, but how much they know. And in respecting how much they know, how much they are, we learn in a way that is far deeper than the simple, you know, swallowing down, memorizing that we get from universities. And I think that that's an important thing to add.
So something we've been hearing a lot more about is in sort of industry, and I've had people on the podcast previously talking about this, is going the step beyond sustainability, is what you might call a regenerative future. In the sort of urbanist world, we would call it like regenerative design or something like that. And I know this is something that you're also interested in. Would someone like to pick up on this idea of going beyond sustainability, what a regenerative future might look like, and maybe some of the problems with the current narrative around that?
Yeah, I think Chris already began to allude to this in a way. And firstly, I think what really stands out in the dominant regenerative discourse is that there is only one regenerative future that we could possibly all come together, hold hands, and work towards. Right? This tends to be very similar, kind of this imported from the global sustainability narrative, particularly the one that's being led by organizations such as the United Nations. And so when we're trying to think about what regenerative futures look like from Global South perspectives, firstly, there would not just be one future. There would be millions. And so it's impossible to answer this question without very specific context, because then you're really talking about hyperlocal regeneration. And it has to be hyperlocal because of the diverse ecologies that we still exist within and are actually trying very hard to make extinct. Without this context, it's very hard to try to even apply what pluriversality could be or look like. And it's also impossible for people in this context, who are existing in this specific context, it's very difficult for them to try to imagine regenerative futures without already having experienced some movement towards decolonial justice. Meaning, if you try and take a community who has been incredibly disenfranchised over the last, let's say, 10 generations, and you say to them, okay, now imagine, you know, some kind of utopian future that you could suddenly live within, what would that look like? That would be very impossible for them to even begin to imagine, because for the last 10 generations, they've been trying to focus not on future imagining, but on survival, on literally what we are going to eat in the next 4 hours. So this space has to be created first, and this is mostly what we focus our energies on, let's say. So while we can't say what regenerative futures might look like, we can say something about the path towards being able to see what those regenerative futures might look like in the Global South. And the path is going to be participatory, relational, iteratively co-created and co-designed, highly, highly flexible and agile, and most of all, rooted in pride in cultural tradition. As you can see, we are so far away. Behaviorally and culturally, our focus in Possible Futures is on nurturing spaces that can allow these collective traumas, these intergenerational traumas, to be processed, to be worked through. What we sometimes call unlearning in terms of the Global South condition, in order to foster the sorts of spaces to allow the support and freedom for traditional and almost neo-indigenous cultures to take hold again. This is to really allow for real self-determined sustainable development to even be imaginable. This is going to be very, very complex, as it requires us to engage with what we call heritage confusion and the cultures that we have lost through European colonization. To do so strategically, we focus on fostering authenticity, integrity, and respect, as Anna already mentioned, through directly and practically challenging power structures in our minds and in our systems by consistently and firmly squashing the narcissism, patriarchy, and ego that coloniality fed to us over the centuries. And I'll hand over to Anna to expand on that.
Yeah, thank you, Chris and Sam. I resonate a lot with what you already said. And I think the main thing is that for a regenerative future, we need to, before discussing that, we need to discuss decolonization, or at least discuss at the same time, not like trying to reach regeneration and then at some point trying to bring decolonization into the discussion. Because regeneration without decolonization ends up being just a performance. It's like trying to plant trees on a land that is on fire. Like, there are so much violence going on, and we can't deny that. And like, trying to create a beautiful regenerative future, denying all of that is happening at the same time. Like, we need to kind of address that first, before trying to, you know, create some marvelous future ahead. And this is, as Chris said, and as Sam said, not just one regenerative future. There are many, and this is the thing, because regeneration has been a discourse that kind of has, it's almost like a script of how it should be done. It's a one story thing, and this should be a pluriversal future. This should be about exactly also listening to stories that have been invisibilized for many years, and even worse, they are, like many indigenous narratives and concepts of the world, are invisibilized, and then these concepts are reframed into a regeneration discourse that is kind of this subjective and kind of rooted in rituals and stories and dances are kind of conceptualized into a rational framework that then can be applied into regeneration. And this is told as a narrative that modernity can understand. So it's a kind of a double invisibilization, you know. It's invisibilization and appropriation at the same time. So I think there is a very long and not easy process involving decolonization before we can even start to talk about regenerative futures, because we have all these things that happened in the past and are still happening in the present that need to be addressed first. But I will pass the word to Nolita.
Thank you, Anna. As Sam said, pride in cultural tradition is important. A part of the decolonial process will be to reimagine what we're striving towards. Who are we? And based on who we are, how will we strive for a future that we want? And I say we, but this we is not universal. It is local. It is personal. It is also family. It requires taking responsibility for our future, no matter how challenging that could be. It requires not being a hero in your story, which tends to be what happens when people take an individual journey, is that they cast themselves as the hero. But instead, it means choosing to be conscious of the type of ancestor you'll be for the future generations and the type of ancestor you're going to be right now. There are many things that would require reframing, and it can have huge impacts on urbanisms and the infrastructure that we choose to build together. For example, the concept of a nuclear family is not as significant in my culture and many cultures in this country as it is, for example, in the American culture, because they speak about it quite a lot. For us, we exist as networks of relatives. Of course, there's a mom, there's a father, there's children. But your father's siblings, you call them mom and dad. If your father has an older brother, you call him older father. You don't call him uncle because he's your father. Your cousins are your siblings. So their children are your nieces and nephews. So the web of family is a lot broader here than it is in another culture. We are so connected, as Xhosa people, that you're not allowed to marry someone from the same clan. An example, my surname is Mvunelo, but my clan is Khateb. There are many people who are from that same clan who don't have the same surname as me, but I'm not allowed to marry them, even though the relation is 10 generations apart. So with that context in mind, how do you then go and build a city with small studio apartments for people to live in? The network of family is big. There's a lot of redesigning that is required for us to get to a regenerative future. And a lot of it requires looking in and taking in deeply who we are and who we're meant to be. And from there, we will have a better understanding of what it is that we can build together. I'll hand over to you, Chris.
Thank you, Nolita. And actually, I'd love to kind of riff off what you said, because family here in the Philippines as well is also very much a complex web of relations, uncles, in-laws, aunties. In a lot of ways, for instance, one's parents, siblings are indeed your other parents. And depending on where you are in the Philippines, it's quite normal, for instance, for someone to quote unquote adopt a sibling's child so that they will have a child of their own. If, for instance, let's say my uncle doesn't have any children of his own, but he wants kids. So he says to my mother, can I have Christina? And then my mom will say, okay. And now I am my uncle's daughter instead of my mother's daughter. And it's normal. And it can be just as loving and just as true of a family connection as anything that may have emerged out of the concept of a nuclear family that was essentially generated by America in the 1950s. In fact, even European cultures are very much intergenerational and nuclear familial. And just to illustrate, for instance, I'm moving home to my home province very soon, and I will hopefully be able to live in the ancestral home because it's a big house and there are many, many rooms in that house, and my partner and I will be perhaps living in one or two of those rooms. One room would be like a living area and the other room would be an office. And everyone else would just, for mealtimes, come together to have dinner and cook together in the kitchen. And there's space for that. And there is space for so many different kinds of families. Families can look like not these complicated webs of relatives, but simply, for instance, a mother and a daughter, or an adult person and a child whom they have decided they want to take care of. That is perfectly valid. And we all have to take into consideration these formations when we think about what a regenerative future might look like for them. Because just to reiterate what everyone has been saying, regenerative futures are only possible when healing begins. And trauma can only begin to be healed once that trauma is acknowledged and the bulk of that trauma is stopped. So if we look at, for instance, a nuclear family that is queer, let's say it has two fathers, that's perfectly normal, but in many societies that is not considered a quote-unquote legitimate nuclear family. And so therefore, one of the fathers would not be considered an actual father or an actual parent. And so that is trauma right there. But once they are acknowledged as a family, as a legitimate and true unit that loves each other and helps each other to grow, then you can begin to think about, oh, how can this family move forward? How can the married fathers grow old together as a couple instead of struggling constantly to be acknowledged as, you know, people who live together and love each other? How can the child of these people be acknowledged as a child with both parents or with two parents who love them? We can't know what their futures will look like until they themselves have the space to decide their own futures. And that is the core, I feel, of decolonial sustainability and what sustainability will look like, or a regenerative future will look like from the Global South perspective. Because the Global South is, again, deeply, deeply diverse, very, very different, deeply invisibilized, and very, very often appropriated and misused. And just to kind of close out, we can't really know what our futures will look like at all, because we have to look both inwards and around so that we can learn how to heal together and work towards whatever that future will be. And that future's blossoming, not only within ourselves, but in our communities. And with that, I pass it back to you, Sam.
Yeah, I feel this need to sort of recognize the fractal that Nolita and Chris have just pointed to, which is essentially around family and how that is defined in different cultures versus what structures we actually build to support that. And applying that to the fractal of essentially the much larger scale of the city, of urbanism. So urbanism in the Global South is heavily, heavily, heavily influenced, at least in the elite world, by European and American urbanism and architecture. And the reason for that is, generally speaking, European colonization and American colonization, and more recently, European and American imperialism or neo-colonization, whatever you want to call it. It's all the same thing, which stems from a sort of Western hegemony within the design world. It's very, very difficult if you try to find any non-global North perspectives in the design world. And when you look at design schools, you know, in urbanism, architecture, etc., in anywhere in the global South, there's always these two, you know, that's where the clash is happening in terms of ideas on design with regards to cities or buildings. Between the traditional and the so-called modern, which is really not modern, but it's just recent Western. And there's always this discourse on so-called modernizing traditional architecture or village design or neighborhood design, etc. But the fact is that it's so messed up, it's so confusing, because the idea of, you know, the core idea of essentially cities offering services, which is the main reason why people would come to the city, including social services, you know, such as places to actually congregate and to hold public discourse, etc. For political reasons or for literally just social like reasons. There are so many different ways that different cultures in the global South actually organize themselves to be able to have these spaces. And yet we import the European ways of doing things and we conform to the European ways of doing things. And when it's not the European ways of doing things, we learn to tell ourselves, because we've been told that for hundreds of years by our colonizers, that this isn't modern. This isn't interesting, you know? So that kind of brings me back to what I originally opened up with, which is the fact that cities, as much as they are designed by our cultural evolution, they also dictate our cultural evolution. So when we think of what decolonial urbanism could be, for example, there's a great, great responsibility in actually working towards real global decolonial justice by influencing essentially our ruling classes to start thinking different, the ruling classes in the global South particularly. And where this might happen or where this might come from would always be this pride, this interest in restoring pride in the traditional.
I wonder, as we're sort of coming towards the end, about 90% of people listening to this will be based in North America, Europe, UK, Australia. I know from the stats that I get on the podcast. Do you have any sort of call to action or anything to ask of them, or any, anything you just like for us to hear in the global North, to sort of take forward from this? Because I think it's a lot to digest in an hour. It's, you know, I hope people will go to your website and will, find more resources to follow up on this. But I think, is there something you'd like to kind of give them, something to go away with and do, to sort of, I don't know, help them decolonize their own mindset, I suppose.
Well, my only ask is not to dismiss whatever they've felt in listening to us, whatever feelings that had come up, whether it be anger, frustration, or disgust, even, or this feeling that, oh, we're so misunderstood, they think we're oppressing you. There's all of these very easy ways to just shove it, right, back under the rug and to ignore it. And I think the request is just not to ignore it. Just ask more. I'll pass on to Anna and see what she thinks.
Yeah, I agree, Sam. I think there's like a beginning on this acknowledging of colonization and all of this that is so complex and so difficult, that is not something fast. So probably if, for example, someone is listening and never maybe heard about colonization, but never like studied into it or investigated deeper into it, that will have, there will be a lot of things that we discussed today that will probably be fermenting for some time, like a time to digest. And this is a long process. It's not like, oh, I heard this podcast and now I'm so decolonized. You know, it's a long process of understanding, and not only on a rational way, but also embodying like this understanding of everything that happened and is still happening. And so I think it's rather about also giving some time for you to compost, like to compost to happen. And I pass the word to Nalita.
Thanks, Anna. I don't think I have much to say in terms of this question. But I think in the work I do, I interface a lot with people from the Global North who are trying to tackle some of these really big, wicked problems. And I get the sense that to some extent, there is an awareness that it's not about understanding, it's about embodying. But what I've noticed also is that sometimes when I take it down to first principles with someone and I say, you know what it is, it's a matter of respect, they struggle with that for some reason. And it frustrated me at first, until I realized that that's where the gap is it's they haven't even taken the step to understand that all of this at some extent is a matter of it's a matter of a lack of respect of other people's cultures, a lack of respect of other people's experiences. And I promise you, making a framework or a matrix or a compass on how to experience XYZ is not necessarily the way to go about it. But maybe to just question and deal with that. And it doesn't have to come with solutions right now. As Anna said, it may take some time, it may take years. But if you took it back to first principles without making it too academic, et cetera, what does it mean to respect other people? And maybe based on that, we could start from the same foundation on how then we can go forward together. Yeah. Chris.
Okay, I'm going to be really, really blunt. And I hope it's okay if I curse. For us?
Go for it.
All right. Remove your heads from your asses. That's what I'm going to say. Remove your heads from your asses. It can be a very slow, painful head assectomy, but it is very, very necessary so that you can finally sit down, shut up, and listen. And I'm not saying listen to this podcast. Listen to the world. Well, I mean, yeah, sure, listen to this podcast. That would be great. But also listen to the world around you. It is screaming. And I don't know how else to describe it. I think Nalita, who had a really, really good, had a really good term there. The first principles comes down to respect. And what is that respect? That respect is about not letting yourself get in your own way. And that's why I'm insisting, please remove your heads from your asses. And that's it for me. Thank you.
Yeah, just to wrap up this bit, in a way, it can seem blamey, and it's really, yeah, it's blamey. But we have to remember that these behaviors are taught. they're taught over generations and they're reinforced basically by, you know, privilege. And that privilege comes in the form of a lot of material wealth, you know. Like Ross said, the privilege doesn't think about these things because it's not part of their world, right? So one way to begin to question is to say, well, why have I been taught these things? Who taught me these things and what was the agenda behind it? And how am I continually being taught these things or how are they being reinforced, etc.? So a lot of those emotions are probably going to lead folk to that place and are probably going to lead folk to try to, you know, question the information that they're being fed, by whom, for what purpose and the agenda. And it can very quickly also lead to conspiracy theory land. I mean, that's sort of the fun part from my perspective. But it's the willingness, essentially, to question status quo, to question power structures, and to figure out your place in this whole mess.
Thank you. Thank you all. I mean, this whole topic of colonization is something that I feel strangely connected to as an Irish person, because we obviously have our own history of colonization by the British. And yet we're, perhaps because of our geography and skin color, we have sort of happily merged with European culture and, you know, wealthy global North countries. So I think, thank you for I'm glad I was able to have so many of you on this call to share those different perspectives from literally different continents. And yeah, I guess before we wrap up, does anyone have anything final they just want to add that they didn't get a chance to say?
Essentially, a lot of the time when people first hear these concepts being shared, they start to latch on to the people that they heard it from, as though we're the only ones who have ever said stuff like this, and that's not true. There's many, many, many people in the Global South who have always been talking about this, always, since literally the beginning of European colonization. And there have almost always been people anywhere outside of Europe, but there have always been people who remain, the indigenous cultures, for example, in North America and in Australia, who are very present and very ready to talk about what justice looks like on the local. So if you happen, for example, to be in North America or in Australia and you want to talk to us about something that you heard, don't talk to people immediately around you and look at what can be done literally in your backyard.
Fantastic. I think that's a great point to end on. There will be links in the episode description to Possible Futures website. But Sam, do you want to let anyone know any ways they can contact you or get in touch or any links or anything?
Please don't contact us. Please don't. No, it's all through our website. And if there's anyone interested to follow our work, we're also on Instagram and LinkedIn.